Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Shag Harbor is a small fishing village at the most southern tip of Nova Scotia, and is named after a bird in the cormorant family known as a shag that calls this area home. The small town currently holds a fluctuating population between 400 and 500 people, depending on the time of year. The major source of income for this town consists of fishing, lobster trapping, and the collection and processing of Irish moss. Irish moss being a type of seaweed found along the coast that has multiple different uses and is commonly processed to have the carrageenan extracted to be used as a thickening agent in many foods. On August 6th and 9th of 1945, two atomic bombs that were detonated on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan marked the beginning of the end of World War II, and the start of a completely different era altogether. Nobody was completely aware of it at the time, but the large-scale intrusion of unknown flying objects throughout the rest of modern history had begun. Along with the first and only usage of nuclear weapons for the purpose of war, the quote-unquote modern UFO era was in full swing, and looking back at reports, it is hard to not connect this explosion of unknown craft with the use of nuclear power. Since then, UFOs have been spotted along nuclear power plants, trailing nuclear power aircraft carriers and submarines, and a few reports even exist of unknown objects being in the vicinity of nuclear reactors, shutting completely down for no apparent reason at all. The first that comes to mind being the Malmstrand Air Force Base incident in 1967, but more on that in a future episode. With the entire history of unknown flying objects plaguing the skies of Earth, there is one that sticks out as being the only government document UFO case on official and public records. This event sent ripples through not only the UFO community, but also stunned the general public and the US and Canadian governments as well. The night of October 4th, 1967 will forever mark the night that a little fishing town on the southern tip of Nova Scotia became the epicenter of a mystery that remains unsolved till this day. Reports were filed by people on the ground, pilots in the air, and captains at sea, as multiple craft were seen in the skies and eventually witnessed crashing into a bay known locally as the Sound on the southwestern shore of Nova Scotia. This event could possibly reach past just a simple sighting of a strange event and may have more connections with the Cold War than many actually realize. Tonight, we dive down into the reports, facts, and speculations of the Shag Harbor UFO incident. Welcome back to Infinite Rabbit Hole. Welcome back to the Infinite Rabbit Hole. I'm your host, Jeremy, and today we dive into the Shag Harbor UFO incident, aka the Canadian Roswell. Honestly, I don't know how I got that name because it really doesn't have a lot to do with anything compared to Roswell other than just UFOs and alien beings. So with that being said, this is an incredible story. Let me tell you, a fan came on the show one time to tell his story. Justin recommended the Shag Harbor incident. Justin is also from Canada, as well as our friend Kenzar, or Kid, as everyone will know her. He requested this quite a long time ago, and it's kind of embarrassing how long it took to get to it. I apologize, Justin, but I do want to say thank you, because I do think that the evidence in this particular event is very substantial. It is very interesting, and I definitely think something happened that night. So, I'm done teasing you. Go ahead and hit that 5-star rating for us here. Please, please, please do that. It helps the algorithm. But without further ado, travelers, here's my report on the Shag Harbor incident. October 4th, 1967. On the chilly night of October 4th, 1967, many people within the Canadian province of Nova Scotia witnessed strange lights in the sky. It is unclear as to whether or not there were more than one that was seen in such a vast area, but there are multiple reports of seeing at least two different lights, and some reports are physically so far apart and at separate times that it is hard to believe that there was only one. Yet most reports claim to have seen only one. At 7:20 p.m., the first report came in from a couple of pilots flying a four-engine airliner over the city of Montreal, which is several hundred miles west of anywhere in Nova Scotia. The pilots claimed that there was a large orange object with yellow lights following them just before an illuminated explosion, which caused the yellow lights of the object to rearrange themselves in a different formation. The pilots wrote an official report which served as a very important piece of information in the future studies of the entire Shag Harbor incident. At approximately 11:20 p.m., a handful of teenagers hanging out at a local wharf witnessed a large object with bright light seemingly change its shape, stall, and tilt forward before plunging into the waters before it. Specific details reported with this particular sighting were a whistling sound and a bright flash of light after entering the water with a large bang to go with it. Just prior, 18-year-old Dave Kendricks and his friend Norm Smith were traveling west on Highway 3 as the boys were approaching the area of Shag Harbor, when they noticed four evenly spaced flashing lights move about in the sky. Shortly after they noticed the lights, the boys watched as whatever the source was began to head down fast at about a 45-degree angle until they were no longer able to see it past the tree line. Lori Wilkins and four others in his car were also driving west on Highway 3 towards Shag Harbor when one of them made mention of the four strange low-hanging yellow lights in the sky. The group estimated the horizontal lights at about 60 feet apart, and the lights were flashing in a sequencing pattern of 1, 2, 3, 4, then all together before repeating the pattern. Soon after they all took notice, the lights changed from a horizontal line to a diagonal one, and they watched as whatever it was began quickly descending behind the tree line. The group lost sight of the lights around the area of Prospect Point, just about 3 miles away from Shag Harbor. While they were unable to see what was going on, the group heard a loud bang and a flash of light before regaining sight once the tree cover broke to allow visual of the bay. What they all reported was seeing a large yellow-lighted dome floating on the water before pulling over in the parking lot of the Irish Moss Factory. A rather large crowd of locals joined the teenagers as they huddled around the embankment leading into the water. The collective group all witnessed a large single-lighted dome ebbing in the tide of the sound only about 600 feet out from the shore. At 11:25 p.m., Lori drove out to the closest payphone in Woods Harbor and called the Royal Canadian Mounted Police Detachment out of Barrington Passage and reported that he believed was a plane crash in the water off the coast of Shag Harbor. The call was answered by then-commanding officer 37-year-old Corporal Victor Werbicki before he and other officer on duty, Ron O'Brien, headed out to the Irish Moss plant in preparation for what they believed could be a rescue effort. Before Werbicki could leave the station, another call came in from Mary Bank, who was at Maggie Guerin's point across the sound from the Irish Moss Factory. She too witnessed the object crash into the water and reported it as an aircraft. Just as the corporal was hanging up, the phone rang again. This time, the reporter was calling from Bear Point, just south of Shag Harbor. This was obviously something at this point, so Werbicki picked up the radio and called out to the only patrol on watch that night, Constable Ron Pond, who quickly changed his direction and headed toward the Irish Moss Factory. Again, as soon as he had made the call over the radio, the phone began to ring again. This time, it was a mother and daughter from the area of Northeast Point in Cape Sable Island, a large island just southeast of the Sound. This was getting to be a lot, so Corporal Werbicki reacted by placing a phone call to the nearby radar base, CFS Barrington of the North American Aerospace Defense Command, aka NORAD, and asked if there were any military flights taking place over the area. The reply was that there were neither any military aircraft in the airspace in question, no overdue arrivals in nearby airports, and there were no reports of downed aircraft. The same answer was given when he requested information from the Rescue Coordination Center in Halifax. A few minutes later, the original two teenagers that we discussed, Dave Kendricks and Norm Smith, arrived at Smith's house. Smith exited the vehicle and began walking up to his front door before he noticed the lights off in the distance on the surface of the Sound. Norm ran in and grabbed his father Alfred before running outside to see the light. His father then ran back inside to wake up his brother Lawrence, who was a small boat fisherman who had to be awake for a long day of work the next morning. But he failed to successfully get him to come along, and the two hopped in their truck and took off towards the water. As the men were getting ready to turn on Highway 3, a police cruiser sped by with full lights and sirens blaring. This ended up being Corporal Werbicki and Officer O'Brien. The father and son sped up after the police vehicle and eventually ended up at the Irish Moss plant with a now large group of people watching the floating illuminated dome, which was now about 1,000 feet away. Constable Pond retrieved a sight glass from the trunk of his cruiser and watched as the craft seemed to be moving under its own power away from the shore with a bright yellow foam being left in its wake. During this time, the constable made a very interesting observation. When the craft passed the sea marker known as the Budget Bayou, the mass of the craft completely blocked out all visual aspects of the float. The budget buoy is 8 feet tall from the waterline, so that told the corporal that whatever it was, it stood at least 8 feet above the water, probably even more due to the angle that he was watching from. Statements were taken from everyone at the plant that night, and a few more details came to light, such as more details about the whistling sound, which seemed to have been alarming in 1 or 2 second burst, but sounded like a cartoon bomb being dropped. The flash of light apparently exploded out of the area of the second light to the left, but the most common thing talked about that night was his concern for any survivors. As Constable Pond was interviewing witnesses, the corporal and Officer O'Brien commandeered a small boat in order to row out to the scene. Shortly after they began their trek, the light disappeared, so the men turned back and Corporal Werbicki made a call to the Rescue Coordination Center that was logged at the facility as coming in at 11:38. The next call that the corporal made was to a local fisherman by the name of Bradford, or Brath Shand, to request a proper boat for an attempt to rescue anyone who may need it. Shand then made a call to his dockmate, the brother of Alfred Smith, Lawrence, who just a few minutes ago was unable to wake up at the request of his brother and nephew. This time, Lawrence woke without an issue, and the men met up at the boats and began the trip out to the area of the accident with Norm Smith on Shand's boat and Constable Pond on Lawrence Smith's. As they approached, the first thing that the men noticed was the eerie yellow foam that was estimated at 80 feet wide, 1.5 miles long, and about 4 inches thick. Large bubbles were erupting from underneath them. The area was engulfed in a horrendous smell of sulfur. One of the younger workers on Shan's boat dipped his arm into the foam. When he removed it, there was no foam attached to his clothing or skin, but there was a very viscous oil substance that adhered to him. Eventually, 4 other boats joined the effort, and just after midnight, the Coast Guard cutter CGC-101 arrived at the scene to assist in the search before the entire operation was suspended at 3 a.m. until first light in the morning hours. By 10:20 a.m., the Rescue Coordination Center had officially described the object as a UFO, as there were absolutely no reports of downed or missing aircraft from anywhere within hundreds of miles of Shag Harbor. Over the next 4 days, an effort made by the Royal Navy and the HMS Granby resulted in 0 answers while searching the waters off of Shag Harbor. Without notice to anyone on the ground, at 12:35, a U.S. Navy air photo mission was underway directly over the crash site from the Strategic Air Command, or SAC. The belief is that the B-52 that took the photos was part of a training exercise taking place 100 miles west of the coast of Maine. The B-52 was originally from Loring Air Base in Maine, which was a known home to the B-52s and KC-135 stratotankers. The entire operation took 35 minutes. This was seemingly enough to involve the events of Shag Harbor in the famed, then-secret Project Blue Book, which eventually made it to the floors of the University of Colorado's U.S. Air Force-funded Condon Committee and was named the sole report in the eyes of the committee that held any weight for the continued research into UFOs and their origins. Night of the UFOs. The event of the crashed object in the Sound off the coast of Shag Harbor was far from the only report of unidentified flying objects in the sky above Nova Scotia the night of October 4, 1967. According to authors Chris Stiles and Graham Sims in their book Impact Contact, the Shag Harbor Incident, the plethora of reports that were made were so many that the night would become infamously known as the Night of the UFOs. Around 8:30 p.m. that night, 12-year-old Daryl Dory, his mother, and his sister Annette were standing in front of their house in Mahoney Bay, Nova Scotia, watching what they referred to as a bright yellow blob of light flying through the sky towards another even larger yellow light. As the smaller light approached the larger one, they merged together into one light and disappeared as if someone flicked off the light in a room. The mother had enough of that and told her children that it was time for bed. Soon after Daryl lay down in his bed, he witnessed another smaller light making incredible movements at fast speeds in the night sky out his window. Eventually, the light disappeared under the southern horizon, and on the morning of October 7th, Daryl, only 12 years old, would write a letter to the base commander of CFB Greenwood describing the event he witnessed above his home. Quote, "Dear sir, I'm writing you a short note about the shiny object which plunged into Shelbourne Harbor. I've placed a UFO report in with this note. The thing I saw was in the sky a number of nights, I've been told, but I saw it only once, and I keep a pretty good track of what goes on in the night sky. The UFO I saw was in the sky the night before the morning it plunged into the harbor, and the last time I saw it, it was heading for Shelbourne. I close for you, yours truly, Daryl Dory." At about 9 p.m. that night, boat captain Leo Howard Mercy and his crew of 18 were fishing about 30 miles south of Sambro Harbor Lighthouse in Nova Scotia when the radar system on board made notice of four separate craft, one of which had three bright red lights about 16 miles away, and the other three were not able to be seen and were reading as about another 6 miles further from the one that the crew was now watching. The crew watched the object for a long time until it shot up into the air so far that it was no longer able to be seen at about 11 p.m. Captain Mercy made a report to both the harbor master in Halifax and the Rescue Coordination Center, but neither could shed any light on what he and his crew had witnessed. Later that night, the captain would be contacted by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police requesting interviews with him and his crew. On October 7th, Captain Mercy would officially file a report with the RCMP, which would eventually be filed away with the Canadian Department of National Defense. At another time that night, 12 herring boats were along the north side of Digby Neck when Captain Walter Titus noticed that his crew was stopped and watching a bright white light in the sky to the southwest. The light was as big as the full moon would be in the sky, and the entire fleet of fishing boats witnessed the large light split up into multiple smaller triangle lights and retreated from the area they were previously in before retracting back into its original shape. The Lent family was watching the event from their home that overlooked the water in Westport of Briar Island. Their report included confirmation from two of the boat captains in the fishing fleet that their vessels were buzzed closely by one or two of the smaller craft. The family reported that it looked as if they were attacking the two boats, but the other 10 were completely unbothered. After about 30 minutes, the lights flew off to the southeast until they vanished beyond the horizon. The radios from all of the boats in the water in the area and more were abuzz all night with their own personal thoughts, experiences, and sightings of the strange lights. In the vicinity of Arthur Lake, Constable Ian Andrew and Forest Game Wardens Burt Green, Don Brown, and Sonny Wagner were staking out in attempts to catch deer poachers. During the quiet mission, the men noticed a bright light moving from the northwest to the southeast about 200 to 300 feet above the treetops. Soon after the first light passed, another smaller one in the shape of an inverted candle flame popped up in view and seemed to be sending sparks off in all directions before descending below the tree line. Both craft were heading in the direct direction of Shag Harbor. Apart from another report from a civilian observer of the crash in the water, the Seal Island Lightkeeper explained that the bottom of the craft looked as if it was on fire as it was coming down into the water. These are only a few accounts that I chose to highlight for this section of the presentation. Honestly, I could have made a 3 or 4 part series on accounts alone. The Shelburne Story. The following days after the Shag Harbor incident took place, there was an additional stir created as another search conducted by the Royal Navy took place for about 7 days, investigating the area just off the shore of the town of Shelburne, nearly 30 miles northeast of Shag Harbor. Why would this area be so extensively searched instead of the waters where the craft was seen? The assumption is that the site where the craft finally submerged was not its final resting place, and it traveled underwater to the area of Shelburne before being left inoperable, and as we will soon see, the evidence is quite substantial. Author Chris Stiles, in his book Impact Contact: The Shag Harbor Incident, provides a lot of really good research and facts about the following days and the search conducted by the Canadian Navy. 7 divers were assigned to the mission of recovering this unknown object, and their story has been famously referred to as the Shelburne Story since the release of the information through many different sources. These divers were interviewed by Stiles in his book, and the names of such remained anonymous throughout his work. But here is what Stiles reports in the sections of the book regarding the famed Shelburne Story. Quote, "You know about Shelburne? There was no doubt about what was down there. It certainly was nothing from here. Shelburne was the real story." These were the opening words provided to Stiles by the diver he refers to as Harry in his book. The ex-Navy diver claimed that in the first hours of the mission, they witnessed 2 craft at the bottom of the harbor. One was seemingly very damaged, and another one was pulled up next to it with beings moving about the outside of the craft. Once this was made aware from the brass of the ship, the mission was shifted from a retrieval to an observation mission. They made the ship stay there for an entire week, just watching as these beings made constant repairs to the broken craft. When they were finished, both craft took off towards the Gulf of Maine and took off into the air and flew away. The specific area in which the operation took place was in the waters halfway off the shore of Government Point in Shelburne and the Cape Roseway Lighthouse on McNutt's Island. This second group was also a part of the HMS Granby operation that was taking place in the waters off of Shag Harbor. The divers who were part of the Shelburne operation described the damaged craft as disc-shaped and were ordered to surface immediately after the report was made that there were 2 craft and multiple beings around the area at the bottom of the bay. The observations were made via microphones and sensors, as well as one of the divers who was allowed to enter the water only to take pictures and film of the operations of unknown beings on unknown craft below the human operations at the surface. According to multiple divers from the operation on October 11th, 1967, a Soviet sub was detected crossing into Canadian waters. The Canadian Royal Navy showed a challenge to the Soviet invaders that were making a beeline directly towards the submerged craft. Soon after the discovery of the Soviets, the craft began to move toward the open sea of the Gulf of Maine before coming to the surface and taking off into the air. The exit of the 2 craft were witnessed by the Cameron family of Woods Harbor at 8:30 p.m. on October 11, 1967. The official report made by the family stated that they witnessed a craft exiting the water at a 45-degree angle near Solomon's Island. The description of the craft that was given had it between 50 to 60 feet wide with 6 bright lights flashing in sequence. The craft remained for 7 to 8 minutes before the lights extinguished and the yellowish-orange lights appeared in their place as the craft began its ascent towards the sky and away from their point of view. The entire incident took about 15 to 20 minutes. The entire time that the search took place off the coast of Shelburne, the median crowds were transfixed on the search happening 30 miles away near Shag Harbor. The entire Shelburne operation was conducted mostly unbothered, and light wouldn't be shown on it in any official format for years. This is now seen as an incredibly successful bait and switch. Author Chris Stiles did phenomenal research into this subject. His efforts involved discussing the subject with multiple boat captains that were and were not working the night of the 4th. By archiving the reports of these captains and the already reported aerial incidents, the connections drew a very clear picture about the events of the time between October 4th and 11th of 1967 in the area. It was during the personal conversation with previously mentioned Captain Mercy that he was able to get a clear path the craft took once it crashed into the water. According to Mercy and confirmed information with other captains, the craft originally landed in the waters off Woods Harbor, roughly 7 to 10 nautical miles away from Shag Harbor. The craft quickly floated into the water off the coast of Shag Harbor, where it was seen by the crowd of people at the Irish Moss plant. As the craft drifted past this point and further out into the waters near Cape Sable before completely submerging and being eventually found off the coast of Shelburne. Two craft then exited the water on October 11, 1967 and were confirmed to Captain Mercy without the knowledge of the aforementioned Cameron family by the worker who was stationed at the Cape Roseway Lighthouse. There is one more detail that seems to be highly important when discussing the Shelburne story, and that is the life of the top secret military base that was in full operation during this time, Canadian Forces Station, or CFS, Shelburne. From the years of 1955 to 1994, CFS Shelburne operated as the country's most top-secret base that supposedly conducted highly important sound surveillance systems during the Cold War and was a joint operation base between the Canadian and U.S. navies. The incredible audible detection system that this base was capable of is a strong indication as to how they were able to find the submerged craft being worked on by unknown beings. But it is the vicinity to the base that really raises questions as to what may have actually been going on. Over the years, a few retired or removed service members that had spent time stationed at CFS Melbourne would come forward and admit that there were plenty of occasions in which the systems were used to track unidentified submerged objects. Pan Am Flight 160. During the recording for a FearNet program, ex-pilot Ralph Loewinger made mention of a sighting he had of an unknown object in the sky when he was piloting a Pan Am flight between New York JFK Airport and London in October of 1967. The flight was designed as Pan Am Flight 160, and the aircraft was a Boeing 707. After about 60 minutes of the flight, the plane was a decent way into the Gulf of Maine. The aircraft was flying between 29,000 and 33,000 feet at a speed of about 480 knots in crystal clear skies at a location that would later prove through research of flight logs that was about 100 miles southwest of Shag Harbor. Loewinger, who was co-piloting Michael Littlepage, who was acting as the flight engineer, and pilot Kurt Olson, noticed a row of four lights off in the distance. Loewinger described the lights as being in a stacked formation and originally believed that the craft was a standard 707 like they were flying, but with all of their lights on. He was proved incorrect when another light was illuminated in a formation that was brighter than anything on a civilian aircraft. Soon after noticing the lights, the men realized that they were quickly approaching the lights. Captain Olson called Boston twice on their approach to the ominous lights and asked if there was any traffic in the area. Boston denied any traffic in this area on both calls, and this seemed to be reflected in the plane's radar system as well, but that wasn't matching what the men were witnessing with their own eyes. The pilots discussed coming out of the automatic flight control system and going completely manual if the situation did not change for the fear of an in-air collision. But as the 707 came closer, the lights slowly began moving out of their flight path before accelerating completely out of sight faster than anything either man had ever seen at a 45 degree angle up towards space. The entire event lasted 6 minutes, and when asked if they wanted to file a UFO report, Captain Olson, now deceased, denied the option. After a review of the flight log, it was proven that this flight took off from JFK at 11:38 a.m. Eastern Time on October 2nd, 1967, almost exactly 48 hours prior to the events of Shag Harbor. Additional information would be provided by author Chris Stiles in his chapter 16 of his book Impact to Contact, the Shag Harbor Incident, when he reconstructs an interview with the flight engineer of that flight, Michael Littlepage. Littlepage would add two different details to Loewinger's account. The first being that there was in fact an entire second crew consisting of another co-pilot and flight engineer on board that were brought into the flight station when they were approaching the lights. This makes six total professionals that witnessed this event. The second was that Little Page was extremely certain that the lights that they saw initially were internal lights, and that the bright light that was illuminated in their direction was the only external light. This actually adds a whole other aspect to many other UFO sightings that I never really thought of. What if the lights that people report coming from UFOs are actually mostly internal rather than external? What was it? So we have a phenomenal case of a crashed saucer in the waters off the coast of Shag Harbor, Nova Scotia. What exactly was it? I think the evidence very strongly points to something actually crashing in the water on October 4th, 1967. The sheer number of witnesses proves that, in my opinion. I am not a component to the mass hallucination phenomenon, especially in this particular event. There were just too many people, and to think that people were hallucinating in different locations about the same thing for a week is kind of ridiculous in my mind, and seems like a lazy answer. No, I definitely think that there was something in the sky that night. Something crashed into the water, and something was seen on the ocean floor. But again, what was it? In Chapter 7 of author Graham Sims' book, Impact to Contact, The Shag Harbor Incident, Sims interviews then-reporter of the Halifax Chronicle-Herald, Ray McLeod, about his thoughts on the matter. McLeod was the reporter at the desk that night, and this event was plopped on his lap to write an article for. He was completely taken back to find out that this article was on the front page and even had a bold red headline to highlight it. But that wasn't the strange part. 3 days later, the local press completely stopped talking and reporting about it. It was like someone flipped a switch and the topic disappeared. The events were still unfolding with the search and the sound still taking place, and the then unknown Shelburne story being played out off the shore of CFS Shelburne. So his thoughts drifted to it being covered up. But why? His best thoughts and rumors going around at the time was that the craft was a top secret experimental craft belonging to the US military, most likely due to the peak of the Cold War, which would happen in and the years around 1967. This would explain the sudden drop in context and scuttlebutt. This would later concrete itself in McLeod's thoughts when the Shelburne story finally was brought to the forefront, as it then solidified the bait-and-switch efforts to cover up the true happenings under the water. Earlier in the same book, author Chris Stiles gives a brief description of the Canadian Department of National Defense sub-branch known as Air Desk. He explains that the Air Desk is the more public Canadian version of the U.S. Air Force's Project Blue Book. The exception is that Air Desk openly investigated reports of UFO sightings and events. Going back to Chapter 7, Sims points out that one of McLeod's sources in his original article was a man from the Air Desk by the name of Squadron Leader William Bain, who was stationed in Ottawa at the time. The headline of Sims' article quoted Bain in saying, quote, "Could be something concrete in Shag Harbor." This lends the belief that the Canadian military was unaware of an experimental, high-tech U.S. military aircraft flying through the skies of Nova Scotia that night. But again, it doesn't really dismiss it either. What about a natural phenomenon? Some people have come out claiming that this was a simple misidentification of a meteorite crashing into the waters of Shag Harbor. This doesn't make sense to the sheer amount of reports that claim that these craft not only moved independently, but also made mention of multiple craft either joining in with another large craft or separating from another. Natural phenomenon just does not move like that. These light craft that were seen in the sky over Nova Scotia that night were completely and independently and intelligently navigated by something. They were not rocks falling out of the sky. Other cases in the area. There were a few very important and high-vis events with UFOs in Canada in 1967. To some, this may lend to the idea that there were experimental craft being flown around the rural areas of Canada just due to the multiple accounts in a given time frame. The thought behind this is that tests of specific aircraft or components of aircraft also are done within time frames and stay pretty consistent until given time frame is expired. But just to compare this event with a few others, let's take a quick look. A deeper look at these events will be done in future episodes of Infinite Rabbit Hole, but for now, let's go over enough to run a comparison. Falcon Lake, aka the Michilak case, of May 20th, 1967, 137 days prior to the Shag Harbor incident. 57-year-old geologist and engineer Stephen Michalek was prospecting for quartz in the Falcon Lake area of Manitoba when this infamous event took place. According to Michalek, he suffered first-degree burns on his chest from the exhaust of what he believed to be an experimental craft. The event included not one, but two of these craft, and were first described as cigar-shaped with humps. The craft changed their general shape a few times, and one was glowing a bright red as if it was burning steel. One landed 150 feet away from Michalek, and the other hovered over him at about 15 feet before taking off upward and disappearing. As he approached the one on the ground, he smelled a strong scent of sulfur. He could hear what he believed to be human voices and attempted to yell out in a few different languages to see if anyone needed help. But he never got a reply and could not understand what they were saying as the sound of their voice was muffled by either the noise of what he assumed was an intake fan or whatever was used to make it hover in place. The craft was completely seamless, and before he got too close, the exhaust kicked up and the craft jetted off away from his position. The exhaust was so hot that his shirt caught fire and a grid-shaped burn was left on his chest. There are a few comparisons to make in this event and the Shag Harbor incident. One, the smell of sulfur. This is probably the single most common and consistent detail in all high-level UFO cases. We specifically have mentioned this in our coverage of the Rendlesham and Kecksburg cases as well. Another detail shared is the changing of the shape of the craft, as well as the bright burning red light, which looked like burning red hot steel. Other than that, the only other really comparable context here is that it was a UFO, and it was in 1967 in Canada. But one particular detail that stands out from this event compared to any that I have researched is the presence of human voices. St. John's, Newfoundland, 1952. Although not in the same year as the Shag Harbor incident, there was another eerily similar account that took place in 1952 off the coast of St. John's, Newfoundland. Graham Sims goes over this event briefly in his book co-authored with Chris Stiles, Impact to Contact, The Shag Harbor Incident. Here he mentions Richard French, a retired lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force who was attached to Project Blue Book as a lead investigator. During the citizens' hearing on disclosure in front of Congress of Washington, D.C. in 2013, French explains a specific case he investigated that involved a down brightly lighted craft in the waters off the coast of St. John's in Newfoundland. The scene was almost identical to Shag Harbor. The local wharf had at least 100 onlookers who watched as this thing drifted on top of the water before sinking. French himself mentioned that when he arrived on the scene, the efforts that were put forward involved watching two gray beings work from a second submerged craft on the damaged craft underwater. I honestly do not feel as if I need to point out the specific similarities, so I will stick with the differences where there only seems to be a few. Those being that this happened 15 years prior and 800 miles away, but both take place in waters that are directly connected to a general area of the Atlantic Ocean. Secret underwater alien base off of southeastern coast of Canada? Who knows? But it's worth thinking about. One thing that Sims points out as a very good observation, in my opinion, is that this would have been a good precursor for the Department of National Defense to know what to do in a situation like this, and maybe why they set up the old bait and switch in the Shag Harbor incident. Bible Hill, Truro, Nova Scotia, August 8th and 25th, 1967. Also included in Sims' book was the account of residents 200 miles northeast of Shag Harbor who witnessed craft in the sky that flashed lights in sequence. The time was 1:30 a.m. on August 8th when reports began coming into Constable Noseworthy, who would eventually confirm these reports with a sighting of his own. 2 weeks later, on August 25th, just 10 days prior to Shag Harbor, people reported seeing lights close to the ground that seemed to be on top of craft of some sort. These lights were also pulsating in a sequence similar to the one seen on October 4th in southwestern Nova Scotia. One witness, a Miss Cooper, and her mother watched the craft for an hour, continually ascending and descending from about 100 feet to 1,000 feet and back. The Smith encounter, November 25th, 1970, in Bear Point, immediately next to Shag Harbor. Stiles includes a chapter strictly on the Smith encounter in his book, which outlines a particular experience by the men previously mentioned in this presentation. Lawrence Smith and his brother Alfred, who was Norm Smith's father from the account where they followed the police cruiser to the Irish Moss Factory to witness the craft floating at sea. Around 9:50 p.m. on November 25th, 1970, the Smith brothers would have a more personal experience with an unknown craft. It began with the brothers spotting orange lights in a horizontal formation, evenly separated in the sky over Bear Point while traveling by car. The car came to a complete stop on its own while traveling 45 miles per hour, and as the car slowed, the light on the far left turned off. The brothers witnessed the lights for 20 to 30 seconds, and as their car stopped, the radio kicked out and stopped working. The light came back and disappeared again before the entire line of lights disappeared for good. The morning after, the local Royal Canadian Mounted Police Station that received the Smiths report received a phone call from Canadian Forces Station Barrington's Colonel Rushton requesting information specifically about any UFO sightings in the area from the previous evening. The colonel explained that one of his men, a Corporal Timothy Nielsen, had also witnessed something in the area, and he wanted to compare Nielsen's report with one from the Smiths. Nielsen's sighting happened roughly 10 minutes prior to the Smiths, about 8 to 10 miles as the crow flies away in Smithville. He reported seeing four orange lights about 300 to 400 feet away. Nielsen and his girlfriend Mary, who was in the car with him, reported that one of the lights, which were in a horizontal formation at equal intervals, had gone out and come back on. The Nielsen encounter also only took about 30 seconds. That's it, travelers. That is my entire report on the Shag Harbor incident. Some really weird stuff that happened, let me tell you. I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't really know a lot about this event until I dove into this book. And thank you, Justin. This was an absolutely phenomenal event to research. Absolutely incredible. And I truly do believe that something happened. People witnessed something. Something crashed into the water and floated away. This is probably one of the better events with the most compelling evidence. I found a lot of evidence. I even found evidence in Project Blue Book. There's definitely a lot here. I know I'm saying that a lot, but that's because there's a lot. I don't know how else to put it, travelers. Anyways, that was my report on Shag Harbor. Don't forget to leave a 5-star rating on your podcast player of choice, and I will see you next time in the next fork in the path of the Infinite Rabbit Hole. Goodbye.
I would like to thank you once again for tuning in to the Infinite Rabbit Hole Podcast. Please make sure to give us a follow and one of those beautiful 5-star ratings on your podcast player of choice. If you would like to join the conversation and stay up to date on all things Infinite Rabbit Hole, head on over to Facebook and search for the Infinite Rabbit Hole Facebook group. You'll know it's us when you see the logo. If you would like to help contribute to the cause, there are a few ways to do so. First, head on over to anchor.fm/infinite rabbit hole and click on the subscribe button, where for $5 a month you'll get access to all our old episodes that will never see the free spotlight ever again. It's horrible stuff, but if you're into that kind of thing, then go check it out. Second, head on over to infiniterabbithole.com and click on the IRH merch shop tab and grab yourself a sweet t-shirt, sticker, or whatever else you see that you wouldn't mind owning. Until next time, travelers, I'm Jeremy, and I'll see you at the next fork in the path of the Infinite Rabbit Hole. Bye.